spending like $5,000 for a brand new small car. That's really an amazing deal, isn't it?
It's probably a lot easier to encourage or incentivize the rich people to spend, the middle class to spend, while at the same time, you know, try to increase income for the people who are in the lower strata of the society. You know, it takes a bit of a time for income at that strata of the society to catch up as the economy improves, as the city government or township government's budget situation improves.
It's a holistic, I think, approach, you know, not just to boost consumption and also investment, but also trying to, you know, improve the living standards of people and also trying to improve the environmental quality. I do believe that this year will mark a very solid recovery and growth, unlike, I think, some of the Western media or academics that believe the Chinese economy is going to stagnate from this point on because of the property market readjustment.
The Chat Lounge.
Chat Lounge.
Chat Lounge.
The Chat Lounge unpacks views and opinions on hot issues in a more casual way.
Welcome to the Chat Lounge. I'm Tuyen. As Chinese people always say, if old things don't go, new things will never come. Well, the Chinese government is pushing ahead with a plan for large-scale equipment upgrades and consumer goods trade-ins to stimulate the economy. But to what extent can such a plan help China's growth? Joining our discussion are Dr. Yan Liang, a professor of economics at Willamette University, and Dr. Zhang Gong, professor of economics, University of International Business and Economics, and Chen Jiahe, Chief Investment Officer of Beijing-based Novomarket Technologies. Welcome to the chat. So the latest figures from the Statistics Authority show China's economy started the year on solid footing, with an array of key indicators in the first 2 months beating market expectations. We know industrial output grew 7% in the first 2 months, well above the 5% forecast from analysts polled by Reuters. And growth in fixed asset investment accelerated to 4.2%, also stronger than market estimates of 3.2%. Well, it's Dr. Liang's first time on the show. Let me begin with you, Dr. Liang. Are you surprised by the better-than-expected figures? Why or why not?
Right. Well, good to talk to you. I think personally, I am a little bit surprised by this better than expected numbers, especially when you think about last year at this time. The COVID lockdown was lifted and the economy was recovering on a solid footing. So I think that retail sales increased by 5.5%. It's already from a high base. And also when it comes to industrial output, we know last year's export demands has been pretty lackluster because of the external demand was low. And so it is pretty surprising and pleasant surprising that the external demand was relatively high. So China's, you know, exports have gone up by 10% in the past 2 months. So I think all of these help to drive this better than expected numbers. That said, I think though, I do believe that this year will mark a very solid recovery and growth, unlike I think some of the Western media or academics that believe the Chinese economy is going to stagnate from this point on because of the property market readjustment. So I think, you know, it is good that the economy is on a solid footing, as you just mentioned. And I think all we're hoping is that this can keep up with the momentum with this good start and with also the policy supports down the pipe.
As you just mentioned, it's a little bit surprised to you, but I think you're not alone in this regard. Would you please elaborate a bit further?
Right. So again, I think first of all is there has been, you know, this sort of problem of weak confidence in the Chinese economy, right, from the consumers and also to producers, to investors. They have been really kind of watching how the economy is going to go. So consumers have been piling up, you know, savings in the past 2 years during COVID years. Last year, they started to spend and we saw the retail sales grew, you know, by over 7%, which is very strong growth. So, you know, when you are growing at a low rate to grow higher, that's easier. But given that last year we have seen really strong growth, that means, you know, with the weak consumer confidence and then with some sort of growth last year, then the expectations this year is probably not going to grow as much. And of course, with, you know, the exports demand, I think that is also a very good sign. You know, last year the global trade has contracted. And so I think few people would expect this year the trade will become much, much better. But I think at least from this first 2 months, we have seen really positive signs. I think one of the reasons is that for some of the Western countries, their inventory has run down. The consumers start to buying again because they have bought a lot, right? Consumer electronics, home appliances during the COVID years. So they kind of take a pause last year. And then now with the expectation that the Fed is going to, you know, soon to lower the interest rates and consumers start to, you know, feel the confidence to buy more again, I think that would help to drive export growth. And then finally, I think, you know, really the real estate sector, you know, it dragged down the economy by quite a bit. Last year, you know, real estate investment shrank by 9.6%. This year continue, we see the contraction of the real estate investment by about 9%. But at the same time, we do see the private investments has gone up and the high-tech investment has gone up. So this year, the private investment, I think this is, again, sort of to my surprise, but it's very pleasant to see the private investment has gone up by 0.4%, reversing the negative 0.4% contraction last year. And so I think that just shows that the private investors start to gain some confidence and they're starting to expand outside of the real estate sector faster than last year. So I think all of this suggests that, you know, it is a good sign that the confidence is coming back, that consumption and investment are starting to expand more. So I think that would put Chinese economy's recovery to a solid footing.
Then to Dr. Gong, are you surprised?
Well, I'm pleasantly surprised. I didn't expect that the numbers could be that good. When I read the press release from the news conference organized by the State Council, I see a lot of 7 there, you know, 7%, this 7%, that 7%. So it's very good news in my view. I think I would refer to maybe 2 or 3, you know, bright spots. I think, first of all, the thing that really makes me very happy to see is that you know, if you break down the growth in value added created by different types of companies, the private companies, the joint venture companies, the foreign companies are actually growing across the board faster than state-owned enterprises. So this indicates to me that you know, the growth is really driven by the market activities, not so much by the government activities. So I think that's a very good sign. The second thing I want to point out is that manufacturing is actually growing, and also the growth rate in the public utilities, including water, electricity generation, that kind of things, the growth in these sectors actually also faster than the service sectors. You know, we got the impression that since the beginning of the year, the service sectors sort of recovered already, but what's lagging behind is the manufacturing and other related sectors. But I think, you know, starting from January and February, the numbers are showing that these sectors that are previously thought to be not so strong are actually coming back with very strong numbers.
Right. Zhahe, Dr. Gong and Dr. Liang are both pleasantly surprised. So what about you? Dr. Liang mentioned especially investment part, private investment came out of her expectation. You are specialized in this field. Were you surprised at all?
Well, if we look at the data for the first 2 months, really in economics in China, it's very special is that we combine the first 2 months together to make comparisons. That's not happening in many countries around the world. And that's basically because we have the special Chinese New Year festival, you know, the spring festival. And that actually sometimes is in the January and sometimes it's in the February. So if we just compare the monthly data for the first 2 months of the year, then it can get a very awkward number if the spring festival is in, you know, for example, in February this year and it's in January last year. So you get a very mixed economic data. So that's why we always, you know, combine these two months together to make comparison. And when we look at the data this month, there are 2 points that we should notice. The first one is that the export has been really amazing. China's export grew by, it's above 10% compared with last year. And that's a pretty amazing number. You know, it really shows you that amid the global economy today, China as you know, the world's largest exporter and the largest manufacturing base is providing a, you know, really strong support to the global economic growth, that China is exporting so many things. And we even have to remember that this is achieved when the trading relation between China and U.S. hasn't been really good in the past few years. But China has actually built so many new trading partners, like with ASEAN countries, Middle Eastern countries, Europe. It's all these trades are actually growing. So that's a very amazing number. The second is that the consumption and the investment has been pretty solid growth. I think the investment grew by something like 7% and the consumption by about 5 to 6%. This is a number that if you go to a mature economy like in Western Europe or Japan and they get something like 5 to 7% growth, people will say that that's amazing because that's really a high number. But if you look at China, Chinese people will say, okay, you know, just about 7%. We'll probably get used to something like 8% or even more. But anyway, we have to remember that this data is achieved amid, you know, the decreasing of the investment and the trading value with the real estate market. China has been pressing its real estate market for years in order to get the bubble away from the real estate market. This campaign is still going on, and we can see that in the first 2 months, the real estate market has been relatively weak compared with 1 year ago. And if you know economics, is that real estate is putting a lot of impact to a country's domestic economy. And this time we got a gloomy real estate market, but we still have growth in consumption investment. That really tells us that the growth potential of the Chinese economy is really large. It's growing at 5 to 7%, even when the real estate market is cooling down.
You all mentioned the growth in investment in exports have brought us a lot of excitement to consumption. Yes, indeed, it also increased, but compared to the growth recorded in factory output and investment, the increase in consumption seems to be not that impressive to some analysts. A Bloomberg report says China's consumer demand remains weak, and Goldman Sachs analysts say more policy easing is still necessary, especially on the demand side, like a fiscal housing and consumption policy. So what's behind the not so satisfactory growth in consumption, especially when you consider there is also a, you know, Spring Festival holiday, which also gave a big boost to consumption, Dr. Liang?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there are several points, I think, regarding to consumption. So first of all, I think one thing to note is that, you know, the Chinese consumption growth has been actually really solid in the past decades. Mm-hmm. When you look at the international comparison, you know, in the past 10, 15 years, China's consumption is actually far exceeding many of the other countries, with exception for a few, like Uzbekistan. So when you look at last year, for example, the final consumption growth has driven the GDP growth and contributed to over 84.5% of the GDP growth rate. So in that regard, I don't really think that Chinese consumption is as weak as some of the Western media or academics are trying to make it to be. I think some of these claims have some sort of political driven motives behind, I think, because, you know, China's large exports, especially now exports of high-tech, high-value-added exports, like automobiles, like batteries, like solar panels, that kinds of growth has spooked some countries. And so, of course, they want China to be able to boost their own domestic consumption. That said, I do think that, you know, the Chinese consumption could increase, especially when it comes to the share to GDP. Mm. So again, I think we need to distinguish the growth rate of consumption, right, which has been high, but because the investment is even higher in the past, you know, decades. And that's why you see this sort of consumption to GDP share that has not been able to reach the high level like United States is close to 80%. China is about 57%. So in that regard, it is low. But I think one of the reasons is really, you know, the Chinese families, households, they do like to save. China's household savings rate is close to 35% compared to American 15%, Europeans 13%. And with the COVID, I think people even double down on their savings. For one is they feel uncertain, they feel, you know, the lack of confidence about the economy. And on the other hand, also, they did not really have the good place to spend their money, right? Mm. You know, people are not buying that many houses, and so they don't buy a lot more furniture and house appliances and so on and so forth, and they couldn't travel. So when you look at the numbers, in 2022, Chinese household savings has deposits have gone up by 17.8 trillion Chinese yuan. And then survey also shows, you know, close to two-thirds of the Chinese people said they wanted to save even more. Mm. So the problem here, I think, is, you know, saving is good in some sense at the individual level. It, you know, help to safeguard and build their financial wealth. But, you know, at the aggregate macro level, and that leads to the lack of consumption. Mm. So I do think that, you know, there are ways for consumption to grow. But again, I think some of the Western medium like to say, you know, the Chinese policymakers don't want consumers to spend. They think this is wasteful, and so they don't want it to really, you know, stimulate demand. And I think that is nonsense. I think, you know, to the top of this level, we heard President Xi Jinping talked about, you know, we want to make the consumers to be able to spend, to have the income to spend, to have the confidence to spend, and also have the good environment to facilitate them to be willing to spend. So I do think that there is, you know, more emphasis now putting on boosting domestic demand. And I know that we're going to talk about, you know, some of the specific measures like trading consumer goods, like, you know, large scale equipment retrofitting. So there are definitely measures that I think the government is trying to boost consumption demand. But right. at the same time, we need to realize the kind of saving propensity, the kind of sort of culture, the kind of family structures in China, a lot of factors, you know, drive this kind of saving behaviors. And it's not something that you can completely reverse in a very short amount of time. So this is going to take some time, and it does take more efforts to create more jobs, more income, and boost the confidence.
Right. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about what efforts should be taken in a while. But as you mentioned, the authorities obviously want the public to spend more on buying new cars, new home appliances. That's why the central government released this action plan to promote large-scale equipment upgrades and a trade-in of consumer goods earlier this month. Like Dr. Liang mentioned, it proposes some major actions, including equipment upgrading, replacing old consumer goods with new ones, recycling and upgrading standards. But it's not the first time for China to adopt similar policies. Back in 2009, the government introduced a plan to promote replacing and recycling old home appliances and automobiles with new ones. So there comes this question: why does the plan this time target equipment in critical industries such as in construction, municipal infrastructure, transportation equipment, and old agricultural machinery, as well as education, culture, tourism, and medical equipment? Dr. Gong?
Okay, well, before I answer your question, I also want to add one more point to your previous question about the consumption. I think you know, one factor that I think is quite important is really the income constraint. When we talk about the consumption here in China, or the inadequacy of consumption in China, I think we're mostly talking about consumption stemming from low-income people, or people with just you know, not so high income, moderate income people. I mean, that includes, you know, a lot of people who are taking manual jobs, and also I would venture to say including people who are civil employees, you know, people work for county governments, township governments, these people. And we have to keep in mind that as a result of the, you know, the fight against COVID, a lot of local governments have accumulated quite a bit of a debt. And that inevitably affects people's income. I mean, I know that, you know, many civil employees are seeing their salaries being slashed, right? So when you have a reduced income or reduced salary, obviously, it's going to affect your propensity to consume. So I think, you know, we need to reverse that situation. I think, you know, it takes a bit of a time for income at that strata of the society to catch up as the economy improves, as the city governments or township governments' budget situation improves. And we just have to be a little bit patient, I think. You know, I think the income level at that level, income level for those people who are not making so much, will catch up eventually. It's just going to take some time. Regarding your current question about this trading plan, upgrade plan, I think we're really talking about two things. One is the trading for consumption. In other words, you throw away your old cars and you buy new cars, recycled. Old refrigerators, white appliances, stuff like that. That's for the consumer market. Now, there's also another piece of this, which is essentially what I call it accelerated appreciation of these capital goods. You know, this is, you know, we're talking about, you know, the capital goods in manufacturing. We're also talking about essentially dress up of the infrastructure, so like in a, you know, city water system, for example, right? Electricity system, you know, the equipment that are quite old. Essentially, I think, you know, we're talking about some government incentives to accelerate the depreciation of these capital goods and infrastructures. Why we do this? I think, well, you know, first of all, a dress up always, you know, makes a better infrastructure that eventually will, the impact will eventually percolate down to production. In other words, you have a better infrastructure, it contributes to productivity increase. So in this case, it's incentivized by the government, I guess through tax incentives. So that will definitely create economic activities and eventually will contribute to the GDP growth, right? And consumption side incentive is the same, more or less the same thing. It just stimulates demand for new purchases. And from a government's perspective, it also increases demand for these sort of consumer products, electronic products, automobiles, for example. I do want to point out one thing. A few days ago, New York Times has an article, in my view, essentially is stoking hatred against Chinese exports. What it's saying essentially is that, China has this plan to export a lot of things. We have domestic consumption is not enough, but we have a glut of capacity. The world is going to be flooded with the stuff made in China. And I think I would call out this article and make a statement here. The idea that somehow free trade can be subject to attack like this is just astonishing to me. I think for every trade, for every transaction, there's a willing buyer and a willing seller. So I think, the free trade has always been United States politically correct, eroded to net for a long, long time. United States established WTO 75 years ago. And now I think free trade is being trashed by a lot of politicians within the Beltway.
This has been the Chat Lounge. We'll check out more possibilities in the new for old plan right after the break.
Sideline Story brings you all things sports related. The hottest topics, latest events, juiciest stories, all with a very personal take. Subscribe to Sideline Story Podcast for heated sports discussions covering events that are happening in China and around the world.
Welcome back to the Chat Lounge. We're discussing how a new for old plan may help stimulate China's economy. Maybe that's why this time we need to rely more on domestic consumption and investment in other fields like infrastructure and things like medical equipment or agricultural machinery. It is because what Dr. Gong just mentioned, that the income growth for the average citizens are not that ideal at this time, especially for those low-income families, that the government this time has put more focus on public infrastructure. Jia He, do you think that makes sense?
If you look at what the government's investment has been doing, they're basically, when they try to boost the economy, they do what private sectors don't do. If you look at government's money, it's very different from private capital. The biggest difference is that it's not talking about short-term return. So if you talk about private investment, is every private investment is looking for profit. They're looking for certain profits, and they're looking for profit in a relatively short period of time because their capital has to be responsible for wherever the money is coming from. For example, the shareholder, the money lender, the banks, everything. So they got a capital that is limited with the time, maybe 2 or 3 years, maybe maximum 5 years, and they're looking for profit. So that means if a project is not profitable to the investor in the short or medium term, and it needs a lot of investment, it doesn't really guarantee you a lot of return, I mean the financial return, but it's beneficial to the society on a overall scale, then that's not the target of private capital. That's the job of the government to do, because government money is aiming for the long-term growth of the society. That's why what we say that the government investment and the private investment has actually been quite different. And that means government is picking these projects that is not really fitting for the private capital. I mean, otherwise, just leave it to the private capital. People will rush in to invest if this project is very possible to generate a return within like 3 years.
Right. Dr. Liang, maybe that's why the authorities stressed the exchange old for new thing in the, especially when it comes to state-owned enterprises, they ask them to change some their equipment for new, and the institutions like medical institutions. But to what extent do you expect those companies or SOEs or hospitals are willing to make such old for new plans? or new for old plans?
Right. Well, I think, you know, the SOEs, the CEO enterprises, I think like what Jack was saying, yeah, they are not just a private profit-driven kind of businesses, right? Mm. So a lot of times they do follow the policy directives of the government. So I would not worry about, you know, the SOEs for having this sort of large scale equipment upgrading and retrofitting. Mm. Like we just mentioned, this covers many different industries, and some of these industries, they are sort of outdated. So they would need to improve the equipment to boost their productivity. So I think there's no reason for the private sector to hesitate to do that, because, you know, they're given money, given the subsidies from the government to renew their equipment. And so I think according to the National Development and Reform Commission, they expected that with all these large scale equipment, this is going to be worth 5 trillion yuan to create a new a market, right, for the new production and new investment on this equipment. So I think they're pretty confident that the enterprises would want to do that. And I think the other things that we know is, you know, this trading consumer goods, that many other countries have done similar things, right? Like in the United States, we call it, you know, the cash for clunks. Mm. People can trade in their own cars and get more energy efficient cars, and they get, you know, somewhere between $3,500 to $4,500, you know, depending on how gas efficient the cars are, they get these different you know, subsidies from the government, right? Mm-hmm. This is after the 2008 financial crisis, 2009, the U.S. government pushed forward this kind of cash for clunks kind of policies. And so consumers were more than happy to trade in their, you know, old cars mm-hmm. for new cars, right, with the subsidies from the government. And many countries have done that, you know, Germany, Italy, Russia, all had varying levels of success. And so I again, have the confidence that consumers will be willing to trade in their own appliances for new, just like the enterprises. But I think, you know, what is also wonderful about this program is that it's not just to trade in the olds for new, but also it's for better, in the sense that, you know, these new equipments for cars, for example, the government was also trying to increase or improve the environmental standards of some of these equipments and appliances. Mm. In other words, you know, you're not going to guzzler for another gas guzzler. The idea is that we need to improve the emission standards so that consumers would continue to, you know, get more environmental friendly appliances and more energy conservation type of home appliances. And the last emphasis is on recycling. Right. So these recycle volumes of, for example, vehicles, it's planned to double from 2023 to 2027. Yeah. So it's a holistic, I think, approach to just, you know, not just to boost consumption and also investment, but also trying to, you know, improve the living standards of the people and also trying to improve the environmental quality. So I think this will be a very helpful program, even though I think the size will still remain relatively limited. Right. We're not talking about this is just one sort of silver bullet that can bring up the domestic consumption by a great extent, because this is still going to be, you know, limited. We're talking about, you know, a couple hundred, you know, billions or at the most trillion dollars, right? Mm. But, you know, China is $18-19 trillion economy. So this is not going to be, you know, sort of one method, right? Fix all kinds of thing. But I think it does, play a sort of a leveraging effect that, you know, when a consumer buy a new car, they probably drive more, they probably will spend more dining out or travel. And so there's some other multiplier effects, I think, with this kind of boost of consumption. But I agree with what Dr. Gong saying. In the long term, I think the key is really to boost jobs in the private sector, especially in the service sector. That's a big job creator. Also try to boost the productivity and therefore wages. And also help local governments. I agree with all these public servants are getting pay cut. That's not going to be conducive to consumption. And also, as we know, in China, local governments are in charge of 85% of fiscal spending. So if the local governments don't have the money, they're not going to be able to deliver education. They're not going to be able to provide healthcare. And all of those are very important to, you know, allow consumers to spend and try to save less for precautionary purposes. Mm. So I agree.
Right. We'll dive deeper into what the government needs to do to for a long-term growth. But like you just mentioned, the trading or the upgrades plan actually worked very well in those countries in the States and in Germany and Russia, like you just mentioned, back in 2009. And it actually brought some short-term effects quite well. Like in Germany, in January of that year, the German government introduced a scheme to subsidize car replacement. And then in April, the number of people who had applied for trade-ins surpassed 1.2 million, more than double the expected number. And in March, car sales increased by some 40%, hitting a new record in 17 years. Maybe that's why the Chinese government also intends to use such a plan to boost a short-term growth, or at least in the medium term. But back in 2009, China also had such a plan. But the outcome was the car replacement only accounted for 1.2% of the target, and the subsidies issued only accounted for 2% of the total amount that could be used, which means consumers were not so excited about trade-ins. So this time, like Dr. Gong just mentioned, there's low willingness among the public to spend, at least for now. So what can the government or authorities do to boost people's willingness to spend in short time? Obviously, in the long term is to increase their income. But what about in the short term? Dr. Gong, do you have any suggestion there?
You know, in my view, I think it's probably a lot easier to encourage or incentivize the rich people to spend, the middle class to spend, while at the same time, you know, try to increase income for the people who are in the lower strata of the society. I think that's probably the strategy. In other words, you know, always consumption is a percentage of the income, right? So you know, with this income constraint, you know, you cannot do much, I guess. I think for a lot of people who are making not so much, they're already stretching thin, in my view. So, and I don't see a lot of prospect of increasing consumption among these people, these families. But you asked about this issue about automobile. I do want to say a few words about that.
Right.
Maybe we can discuss this later. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we all understand that the lot of cars being sold in major cities in China, and in many cities we have this restriction about license plates and therefore buying new cars, right? I have always had this, you know, very strong opinion about this issue. You know, I can't understand where the municipal governments are coming from. I mean, they want to solve the traffic jam problem. They want to discourage people. They just want to see more cars on the streets. That's okay. I don't have a problem with that. But the issue is that, you know, you don't want to discourage people buying cars. You may want to discourage people driving, but you don't want to discourage them buying cars. So I think, you know, a lot of these restrictions in major cities like Beijing and Shanghai are fairly dumb in my view. I think moving forward, this issue should really be discussed. I think this policy is very difficult to tear apart, to topple, because, you know, there are people who have vested interest in sustaining this kind of a system, especially, I think, those people in the municipal governments controlling the license plates and all those things. I think they've got to be, you know, coming from the top to really take a hard look at this policy, whether it's a clever idea, whether it's achieving the objective it is supposed to achieve. I have strong doubt about this. So you know, I have a strong opinion about this. So I vehemently advocate dismantling all these restrictions, but you know, we can still address the traffic jam problem by, you know, restriction, by disincentivizing people to drive, right, through this kind of a policy.
Indeed, you actually echoed with some suggestions or proposals made by some lawmakers and political advisors during the two sessions, which ended earlier this month. They're China's most important political meetings. And Jia He, you obviously belong to, you know, the rich group mentioned by Dr. Gong, or at least middle class. So from your perspective, what kind of stimulus policies that the authorities issue could, you know, encourage you or people like you to spend more?
Well, regarding my personal spending, I'm not too sure. I mean, one of the switching stimulus that they actually came out in recent times that you can use your old consumption equipment like a mobile phone or whatsoever to buy the new one, and there is a subsidy given, and that's something really attractive to me because my current mobile phone is like been 2 years old, so usually I change it for like 2.5 years or 3 years. But, if there's a plan, maybe I can try the new Huawei type because it got much better signal compared with other phones. So I was actually thinking about this last night. It's not about how much money you really have, because if you got enough money and you see there's a subsidy and you can get like a few hundred or a thousand yuan just by clicking or a mouse or tap on your mobile phone, then you would get it. So why not? I mean, it's still the money. So it's, I think it's actually working for everyone. And with more subsidies given in particular areas, people will come over and do more of the shopping. And another shopping that I'm currently thinking in recent times is, buying a new energy vehicle because I haven't been driving in the past. I got my driving license for decades. I think I got it for like 2 decades. Mm. I got it while I was a university city student. But because, the taxi system is so convenient, so I never bought my own car. But recently, I see more and more, fundamental infrastructure for new energy vehicles is growing on the street. It's much easier for you to recharge your car compared with like 5 years ago. And the price of new energy vehicles is so cheap. I mean, in China, you can get a medium one for like, 100,000 yuan right now, or 120,000 yuan. So if you convert that to US dollar, that's about somewhere about 15,000 USD, and you get a very good car. And if you want a small one, like the one I'm planning to get, it's much easier for parking and much easier for driving. It costs you like 5,000 USD for a brand new small new energy vehicle. So that's something a good price, and it's some kind of subsidy that the government is giving in as well. That's why the price has been dropping so low. So, spending like $5,000 for a brand new small car, that's really an amazing deal, isn't it?
Mm. Right, but some people suggest we should start trading in old houses for new ones, like killing two birds with one stone. Is that a good idea?
Well, the housing would be something really different from the daily consumption we're talking about, because if you look at the price that it would spend for a new laptop, that costs like 5,000 yuan. If you talk about new energy vehicles, and if you buy a new brand new one, that costs about 100,000. And if you got an old one to make an exchange, that costs you even less, maybe 70 to 80,000 yuan would do the job. But if you talk about property, that's a very large amount of money. And that talks about millions, at least 1 to 2 million in many smaller cities in China. If you talk about tier one cities like Beijing, Shanghai, and Shenzhen, you're talking about something like 5 million or 10 million yuan. That's a very large investment.
Mm.
So that's something really different. People consider very differently when they think about should we have a new house compared with, daily consumption.
Oh, yeah.
Daily consumption is that kind of, if you give me some subsidy, like 20%, and I have the incentive to change my mobile phone, in the next 6 months, I'll probably just do it now because of the subsidy. But when you talk about the housing market, that's different, because if you want to give like 10 or 20% subsidy to the housing market, that's too large an amount of money to be afforded by government. And it's also, on the other hand, is that China's government is still trying to make sure the property price does not increase, or at least it does not increase as much as it was before, like 20% per year. If you look at the market between 2010 and 2020, the property market can grow like 20% per year. And people were rushing in back then because, buying the property means making money. But now is that the story is different. Buying the property doesn't mean make money instantly. So that's actually changed the consumption behavior of most of the property buyers. If you think about it, you're going to spend like 3 to 4 million and get a debt from the bank for 20 years, the mortgage. And you think you do this consumption and you're not making money right away in 1 year, the price is going to be probably the same 2 or 3 years later from now. You're not thinking about this consumption right away. You'd be very cautious about that.
Indeed. Maybe it's more realistic to install elevators in old buildings.
The Chat Lounge. The Chat Lounge unpacks views and opinions on hot issues in a more casual way.
So, Dr. Liang, share your thoughts here with us, please.
Right. Well, so first of all, I wanted to just compare a little bit the example that you provided, back in 2009 when Chinese government had the programs to upgrade both for automobiles but also home appliances. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think the home appliances had certain success, right? When you look at Beijing, for example, just within a month, they have recycled and, you know, took back 113,000 old appliances. And so they promoted a new sales. And some of these chain electronics and home appliances stores have shown that their sales have gone up by 30% within just that 1-2 months time. Mm. So I think that was quite successful in terms of the trade-in home appliances. For cars, I think one of the biggest problems is that, you know, the subsidies is still very, very low. So a lot of the secondhand car owners, when they really sell their cars in the secondhand market, mm-hmm. They actually get more than double the amount of money they could have got from trading in their old cars and also getting the subsidies. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, insufficient amount of subsidies and also, you know, very complicated procedures to do the trading, I think that really dissuade some consumers from doing it. So I think this time around, if we're able to double down the amount of subsidies, the amount that, you know, consumers can really get from trading in their cars, I think that could really help to boost the efficiency and boost the effectiveness of that. And that's why, you know, when you look at the history, right, the past, the government really trying to increase the subsidies by several times. I remember back in like March, they increased the subsidies from 600 million to 1 billion. And then they increased that again just 2 months later to 5 billion. So it's just, again, you need to provide sufficient amount of subsidies to lure the consumers, right, to trade in the cars. And I also wanted to point out that, you know, back in 2009, there was not really a lot of secondhand cars in the market that is qualified for the trade-in. So you wanted to make sure that your standards are not set too high. So then, you know, consumers actually have the cars. And right now we're talking about, you know, 336 million consumer, you know, vehicles in China right now. So I think there are many cars that are at the age of, you know, retirement. So I think hopefully that this time around, you know, with more subsidies and more secondhand cars, and then hopefully with more streamlined process, this could, you know, incentivize consumers. Mm. When it comes to the trading old houses for new, I think that's a very interesting thought. I know for the fact that, you know, countries like Japan, for example, they always have, you know, their residential house upgrading every, you know, 20 years or even less. Because they always have to upgrade their earthquake-proof kind of structure. So I think in a way, this is going to help to improve or increase the demand for housing renovations, you know, constructions. So to some degree, I think this is helpful, right, when you continue to renovate houses. But I do think that this trade-in, first of all, it's going to require a lot more investment. And second, I think, you know, house is different because location, location, location. So there's a question about, you know, where do you move people to, you know, what kind of new houses you could provide them to, you know, substitute the old house in the old location. So there, I think there are quite a bit of details. And, you know, as we said, the devil is in the details. I do think that there is potential, but you really need to think it through how to do it. I think in some ways, the urban village revitalization, right, that I think it's a similar idea that we wanted to, you know, upgrade the old houses in the city villages, and then to be able to kind of upgrade those houses and renovate them. And so that would be able to provide new housing for the residents. I think that's actually a pretty similar idea.
Obviously, the plan spans some year. I think it's the expectation is it will create an enormous market worth more than 5 trillion yuan or some 700 billion US dollars by 2027. So it's not a short-term plan. It's kind of like a medium term. So
yeah, I think that's for the large-scale equipment upgrade. I think that is the number that they were hoping to be able to get for, you know, the large-scale equipment renewal is going to create, you know, 5 trillion yuan or $704 billion of market to produce and, you know, to produce all these new equipments.
You have no doubt that the central government can support such a plan. Even
I have no doubt.
Right.
I have no doubt. I think
with increased debts.
Yeah, I think our central government's debt is actually very low. The GDP ratio, right, that's around 20-some percent, a little bit over 20%. That's a central government you know, debt to GDP ratio. That's very low by any measures, you know, for global comparisons and all of that. So I have no doubt the central government can do that. I mean, I actually subscribe, you know, to this sort of modern monetary theory. And there are many other reasons if we just, you know, not even just to say, you know, the Chinese central government is not going to run out of the Chinese yuan. But even if we don't go that route, right, I think even the IMF has acknowledged that, first of all, the central government debt is low. And second of all, the central government has also a lot of assets. Mm. They have, you know, $12.5 trillion worth of assets as of 2019. So I think, you know, by any standards and measures, I don't think the Chinese government at the central government level is very sort of highly indebted. So I do think that they have the physical power to launch these kinds of programs.
Right, fair enough. Such a big market waiting for, I think, investors ahead. So there comes the question, what kind of companies or sectors will be the biggest beneficiaries? Jia He, it's your specialized field.
Well, are we talking about which company is going to grow a lot, or are we talking about investment targets? Well, because that would be different, because investment means you know, good company fundamental
collapse, market opportunities there.
Price. Okay, if we talk about market opportunities, that's my expertise. I know which company.
Right.
Because that means good business fundamental plus very attractive price. So these are two very important things, because if you have a very good company and everybody else knows that it's a very good company, like many tech companies in the United States right now, it's probably not a chance for you to buy, because you are paying a lot of price for that. And that means if you come over to the Chinese market, you find a lot of good targets, because they're trading at so attractive valuation and their fundamentals are also growing, you know, in Hong Kong. In Hong Kong market, we have got quite a heavy stake with some of the state-owned large banks, with a medical company. We got about 8% with automobile companies, because everyone is betting that the automobile company is going to be bid by the new energy vehicle. But if you look at some of the traditional automobile companies, pretty strong with their financial statements, and they're working very effectively on the new energy vehicle as well. So that valuation really attracted me. Mm. And I got a large stake, about 20% of the stake, with a port company, you know, because if you look at China's international trade, it's one of the most important economic activity, both for China and the global economy. So when you look at the whole industry of global trade, then you have the trading companies, you have the shipping companies, you have import and export companies, and you have the port companies. And for these four sub-industries, you can see that the port companies are mostly competitive. They don't have competitors in their own field. I mean, a shipping company would fight against another shipping company for a lower price. Well, lower price means less profit for the company. But if you look at port companies, it's that they don't really have competitors. They're a monopoly with their own local economies. You know, every province, if you see the major ports there, you don't have competitors. They charge whatever the price they want. And that's why the government usually sets a limit for them, saying that you can't charge whatever you want. You have to, you know, leave some profit to the other companies. So their profit is usually determined by the government's limitation at about 10%. So, but anyway, that's still a good thing, because that 10% is almost the guarantee. So port companies takes about 20% of my position as well. So following this strategy, you find a lot of attractive industries and companies in China's market.
So as you all mentioned, that to promote consumption growth depends a lot on the growth of household income, obviously individuals as well. And in the long term, promoting consumption growth also requires economic structural changes and building of consumer confidence. So Dr. Gong, what measures are currently in place to advance this goal? Are they strong enough, what the central government has introduced, strong enough to support such a transformation?
Well, actually, in my view, these policies don't have to be strong enough in the first place. I think the economy is running its full course. It's doing fine. I mean, look at we've just discussed the first 2 months of the year's numbers. They're actually fairly decent numbers. So I think, you know, these policies certainly will help. But even if, you know, in effect, they don't achieve the kind of effect they're desiring for, still, I think we should be okay. I think, you know, even without the current policies in place so far, you know, the economy is running okay, I think. You know, I would turn around this issue and say, look, you know, these are good policies, but even if they're not that effective, you know, what's the big deal here, right? And by the way, these policies are targeting a long-term vision anyway.
Right.
So I wouldn't bank on, you know, seeing some immediate results in the next few months or so. I mean, it really doesn't matter in my view. I think, you know, we've already discussed China's economy is on a solid footing right now. And moving forward, I would imagine that, you know, the 5% growth rate target is going to be still fairly well maintained, if not even better.
Mm. Obviously, if the plan can be carried out or take effect as expected, there won't be a question that the economy will continue to grow. But there is also this problem. If there's something unexpected coming during this process, it might interrupt such a momentum. So the question goes to Dr. Liang. How long do you expect the momentum to continue? And if there is any interruption during this process, what would be the biggest challenge then?
Well, I think I would say it's quite of a sort of consensus, right, that the big downside risk to China's economy today one has to do with the property sector. It's going to continue to adjust. And we know this is going to be a relatively long-term process. It's going to take years for, you know, the excess inventory to be exhausted, for the uncompleted, you know, houses to be finished, for some of the enterprises to really go through the bankruptcy and restructuring process. It's going to take time. When we look at Japan's example, that's really a long-term process and was a very kind of ugly adjustment that, you know, brought evidence the last decade. When we look at the United States, you know, it definitely didn't go well. The 2007-08, you know, financial crises, the housing crises basically led to the, you know, global financial crisis. And it took, you know, almost more than 10 years for the United States to recover. So I think we should not underestimate the downside risks of the property sector adjustment. You know, for anyone who said, you know, China's economy is lackluster, it was stagnating, I think they should really put this real estate adjustment episode in context, right? That I think China is able to manage still 4.1% of growth rate of the last 2 years on average with this property sector adjustment. I think that it's really laudable, but still, you know, this is sort of the risky area. If it's not well managed, right, that could generate some sort of financial turbulences, and it could continue to weigh down on income and wealth and consumption. So it's a very, I think, broad range of impacts.
Right.
The other risk, of course, has to do with the local government debt. That is really, I think, the, you know, sort of the elephant in the room, that I think the central government right now is really sort of dodging the problem by issuing long-term central government bonds, right? 1 trillion then last year was half to be spent this year, and then this year another special bond, ultra long, 1 trillion yuan. So I think this will help the local governments, especially some of the most indebted, under the debt distress local governments. But I think going long term, there should be some kinds of fiscal reform to really rebalance the, you know, revenues and the expenditures of the local governments to really put that kinds of ongoing kind of debt crises to an end. So I think those are two biggest risks that need to be managed well for the economy to keep up the momentum. And I agree with, you know, Dr. Gong. I don't think China's consumption is as weak as some people would like to paint it as. But at the same time, if we do want to continue to bolster consumption, then yes, we do need more job creation, because I think all these advanced manufacturing is to reduce labor, right, to boost that efficiency and using more machinery. And so the question is then, where do we get jobs, especially for the young people?
Right.
So I do think that job creation is important. And also the service sector needs to be more attended to. Also the rural urban divide, I think that needs to be addressed, especially for migrant workers. So I think all of these would be helpful to boost the long-term growth in terms of consumption and therefore the economy. Now, one last thing that I think also is another downside risk that, of course, has to do with geopolitical tensions. So with the United States election year this year, and with Donald Trump has been talking about, you know, 60% of tariffs on Chinese products and so on and so forth, I think does create some risk because there is a good chance that Donald Trump is going to be elected. And so I think, you know, he definitely does not constrain himself from destabilizing the relationships between the two countries. So I think that is definitely something I think China needs to manage and manage well, not only for the sake of the economy, but really the global security and, you know, the whole world and peace. So I think that's very important.
Quite comprehensive. And with that, we've come to the end of our chat. Many thanks to Dr. Yan Liang, a professor of economics at Willamette University, Dr. Zhang Gong, professor of economics, University of International Business and Economics, and Chen Jiahe, chief investment officer of Beijing-based Novem Arcade Technology, for sharing your time and insights with us. The show is available on all major podcast platforms. If you have anything to say about the topic or the show, just email radio@cgtn.com. I'm Tu Yun. Thank you for listening. We'll have more chat next week.